Mute. All right, folks, welcome to another episode of Crew Call with Mike Rose. This is episode 5-1, January 2024, first one of the year. And we're talking with a new friend of mine, Robert Stafford. I'm calling him Bob because that's what he calls himself. Bob approached me after seeing me on another podcast that I'm sometimes on, and he offered some information that I immediately thought was so interesting to me that I thought it would be interesting to everybody. You know, people know what engineers do, people know what conductors do and brakemen and things like that. Bob's coming at this from a different angle. So I deliberately didn't ask him any questions because I wanted to ask them all on the podcast. So, Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
You did send me a little bit of bio information. It says you came from a Lackawanna railroad family. What can you tell me about that?
Oh, I can trace history back to Elmira, New York. Been like a great, great, great grandfather who actually chosen the city roster in 1880 as being a Lackawanna Railroad fireman.
Okay. Steam duty.
And I had uncles, great uncles, I remember, were yard masters in Buffalo, Elmira, and in a train service in New Jersey.
Okay. Okay. And he says you got a flyer set when you were 3 years old. You've been a model railroader ever since. We're not recording video for this podcast, but I can just see in the background, you've got a whole modern construction methods layout under construction there. It looks nicely ambitious. So what? Just as an aside, what's your layout going to be?
This is the Susquehanna and Hudson River Railway.
Okay, and so it's a freelance model railroad.
It's operating from the anthracite coal fields to Maybrook, New York, and okay. Jersey City.
Nice.
Sort of modeled after the Lehigh, New England, and New York, Susquehanna, Western, that kind of feeling.
Yep. I take it this is not your first railroad.
Oh, no. It's like maybe the 15th.
15th. Oh, my God. So you
I moved too many times.
Yeah, you have it done, and this is the life of the railroader, I guess, which is you know what we're going to get into here. By contrast, I'm still in the town I grew up in, and I've only lived in three places. And the house that I'm in right now, I've been here for 37 years, and I about 4 or 5 years ago, I put on a big addition to the house to accommodate more model railroad space. So I would say my experience with this kind of deal is the exact opposite of yours. So I commend you for starting 15 model railroads. I don't know if I would have had that in me, but you know what? I guess if you have the bug, there's no stopping it, right?
Right.
So how big is the layout that you're building currently, approximately?
Okay, the part that's... The main part of it is an L-shaped room. Basically, I live in a duplex house.
Okay.
And my mother lived on one side. We lived on the other. And after my mother passed, we remodeled her side. And then the other side became my train house.
Ah, so you have a whole house to build a model railroad in.
It started that way. Then I got the idea I could partition the back part off and make it into a one-bedroom apartment back there.
Okay.
Additional income.
Sure.
And so the front area here is L-shaped. It's straight across. It would be 15. It's about 26 feet straight across, and it goes back about 16 foot.
That's good size.
And the side it used to be the front bedroom is what? 11 foot wide, and in the area that was used to be part of the living room is 15 foot wide.
Yep. So this is a plenty adequate amount of space. What's the era that you're modeling?
Early 60s.
Early 60s. Okay. So you're going to do a little, will there be any steam involved or just first generation diesel mainly?
first generation diesel and maybe a few GP35s or Century 424s.
Yeah, no, it's a nice era to model. So, all right, so you're doing your modeling thing. Tell me a little bit about how you got started in the real railroad. Like, what was your first gig? You said you hired out on the EL as a towerman, or I guess you started as an agent, right, at that time?
Well,
or is that one and the same?
Okay, let's put it this way. My grandmother always told me I was born to be a railroader. I had the bug since I was as long as anyone could remember.
I hear that a lot from real railroaders. I do.
Yeah, my Uncle Jim at that time was a conductor on the passenger train between Washington, New Jersey, and Hoboken.
Okay.
On the Lackawanna. When I was a little kid, my mother would put me on the train and rushed like a couple stations ahead to beat the train to pick me up. And I was a little kid. I wasn't even a kindergarten yet. I get to walk the aisles with a ticket punch.
Wow.
And I get to punch the tickets for it. Okay.
Very interesting.
That was the best job in the world.
I'll bet.
Okay? I was going to be a conductor one day and punch tickets. That was my goal.
Yep.
But before I was even in kindergarten. Okay. So anyways, when I got out of high school, first place I went was the Hoboken. Tried to hire out. Railroad wasn't hiring anything. But so then I waited about 6 months, went back again. And the chief train dispatcher, Jim Conboy down there, he told me to come back on the 16th of September, 1972, and I'll have a position open.
Somebody was retiring, I guess?
I'm not sure, really.
Yeah. But
anyways, at 5 a.m., I was camped out at Hoboken at the outside of the train dispatcher's office waiting for him to come to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I got hired that day, September 1972. Immediately, I got assigned to third trick at Port Morris Tower.
And I imagine you were posting at this time, right? You were learning the job with someone.
Yeah. So I spent 3 months there. Then I didn't move around much in EL. Then I went to Berry Hill as the agent there. And then from there, I went to Bangor, Pennsylvania as the agent there.
So before we go too far, let's make sure we all understand exactly what an agent does.
Oh, okay. The agent, back in the days before computers and fax machines, was the railroad's local representative.
Okay.
The agent was responsible for serving all the local railroad customers, doing all the accounting work necessary for the customers, giving them their freight bills for inbound loads, collecting the money for the outbound loads, handling the spotting of the cars.
Really? And doing, so when you say collecting the money, you literally send them a bill?
Yeah.
And make sure they paid it?
Yeah. Yes. We would hand type out the bills.
Right. Right.
And give them to the customers. And most of the customers had a credit agreement with the railroad where they had 7 days to pay the freight bill.
Sure.
And then they would give me a check. And then every day we put the checks into an envelope, mail them to the auditor of disbursements office in Cleveland, Ohio.
Wow. And when you say they'd give you a check, would they give it to the crew or drop it off at your office? Or
they would drop it off at the office, or if I was out doing a yard check, they would give it to me.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So that was probably a pretty good gig, wasn't it? Like you got to see everything that was going on, and it probably wasn't like being a dispatcher in terms of the intensity of it, right?
Right. Yeah. No, I very much enjoyed being a railroad agent. It was because I got to interact with everybody.
Right. Did computers end that gig for you?
Computers came later.
Okay.
When I started in 1972. In all the smaller stations, there was no computer. Everything was manually done.
Okay.
That came later. The larger yards on the railroad at that time had computer systems that were, uh, I IBM punch cards.
Yep, big mainframes.
And some places had Model 35 teletypes.
Yeah, I guess a place like, say, Selkirk would have been like that, right?
Maybe. Yes, I would think so.
Yeah, okay. So,
anyways, when I was the agent at Bangor, Pennsylvania, Bangor was one of the stations that was had, on the railroad, there is a tariff where if you were to load primarily grain, but there's other products too, and if you were to ship a product from like Chicago to New York City, and if it stopped en route, like in Buffalo, and the grain was milled into flour,
okay,
then it was reshipped back out. Okay, that was called a transit rate.
Okay, so it was one rate to get it from the source to the company that would be doing something with it.
Right.
Okay.
And there was a lot of bookkeeping that went with being doing the transit work. And you had to figure the freight rate based on the day that the original shipment of wheat left its originating station.
Okay.
Okay, that could be 2 years prior.
Really?
Yes.
Because it could
and
be,
then,
geez, okay.
And so then the rate through for the milled product would be figured out on the rate that was in effect basically 2 years prior.
Where would that information about the date come from? Like, how did you know?
Okay, well, all that information would have been what was called the EL 245 tariff. Tariff number 245 was the ERILAC 1 is grain tariff, basically. So all the rates and everything were in that particular tariff. So you had to be able to take that tariff and all rate increases and things, and you had to be able to calculate all of that.
Okay, I get that. The tariff is like the rules. But if you had a particular shipment, how would you know, like where did you get the information that you would apply to the rules? Like that particular shipment had an origin date. Where was that date recorded? On a waybill or something?
Okay, on the inbound waybill, you had the information off your inbound waybill, which you then copied that onto a freight bill, which was presented to the customer.
And a waybill would have been with the crew, right? The conductor would be in charge of the waybills?
No. Well, the conductor would give the waybills to the agent.
Okay.
And the agent was responsible for the waybills at destination.
Okay.
Okay. So you would give your freight bill. The customer, in turn, had to account for every pound of grain that went through their facility. It had a big sheet of paper. It was about probably 5 foot long, about 30 inches high, with all these columns on it. Now remember, this was before computers.
Jeez.
And all this information was manually written on them.
Big chart.
And then the customer was allowed a 2% shrinkage in milling. So when they went to ship their outbound flour product, they would then apply the weights from certain inbound loads to that shipment. So the date that load arrived was the date used for the billing of the outbound rate. It's very complicated.
It should, in theory, be 98% of the original weight.
Yeah. So if they got in a car with 100 tons of grain and they're shipping out 50 tons of flour in a 40-foot box car, which is what we used back then, primarily. So half of that weight from that particular car would be applied to that outbound shipment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would get into situations where you would have two different cars applied to it, or three different cars applied as they were combining the weights together to come up with the outbound shipment, and then they would have split rates. So it was quite complicated to figure out.
Armies of people employed in doing all of this, right?
Well, most of the time the feeder flour mills would have one person in the traffic department. That was their primary job.
Yeah, but I mean, so in other words, yeah, that was a full-time job for somebody, but on the railroad, lots of people doing this.
Yeah, well, the individual agents who were billing the outbound cars out had to figure these rates.
Right. I mean, if you had to guess at the time you were doing this, how many agents were there on the railroad?
Practically every large town had an agent.
Right.
There was thousands of us throughout the country.
Wow. Amazing. So when you did your agent thing for a while, and then what was the next thing that you moved to?
Well, because I got good at doing transit, this was called transit billing. The local transit inspector for the Eastern Wayne Inspection Bureau of the Eastern Railroad Association, he had a heart attack and he couldn't come back to work anymore. And the Railroad Association is made up of employees from the member railroads.
Okay.
Who are on leave of absence from the railroad to fill the vacancies.
Okay.
So that had historically been a Lackawanna job. So I got tapped for that job because I was put into billing and transit. And so in January 1975, I become a auditing inspector for the Eastern Wayne Inspection Bureau.
Okay.
And it was the region office was headquartered on the fourth floor of Reading Terminal in Philadelphia.
So how did your experience as an agent dovetail with your new duties? Like how different was it?
Well, a lot different because totally different responsibilities. I became an auditor now instead of a local rep for the railroad, and I also work for all the railroads in the Eastern United States.
Right. So you're checking up on people.
Right. Yeah. My job was checking up on people.
Yep.
So my primarily job was handling shippers' weight agreements. Okay. A customer would enter into an agreement with the railroad that the railroad would accept the customer's weights for the outbound shipment. And okay. In turn, the customer agreed to be periodically audited.
I see. So you're checking scales and procedures and that kind of thing?
Yeah. So okay. I would go to the shippers who had weight agreements, and I would audit their outbound weights, like you're modeling Mahoopany.
Yes.
And I would go to Charmin Paper in Mahoopany.
Wow.
Okay. And
would you go to the cider mill office?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 The Lehigh Valley. Yes. Cider mill.
Wow. And did you also get into the plant, or was it all on the outskirts?
No, it was in a plant.
Okay.
I just went down to the cider mill and hung out to visit the agent and clerks down there.
Gotcha.
Because I was a rail fan, basically. Okay.
I gotcha. What was that guy's day like? Was he super busy as an agent?
I remember, yeah, first trick, he had an agent and I think two clerks. And on second trick, there was two clerks working. I was never there for third trick. So.
My understanding is that they were originating upwards of 100 outbounds a day.
Well, that's probably about right, because yeah. I used to have to go there every 3 months because the amount of time you went to audit a place was dependent upon the volume of the outbound traffic.
Right, right.
Okay. Because the warehouse in Mahoopany could hold 48 50-foot boxcars on the inside of it, as I remember.
Right. Four 12-car yeah. spots.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I would go to...
And those were 40-foot boxcars, right, at the time?
Oh, they were 50-footers.
They were 50-footers. Okay.
Yeah, they were 50-foot boxcars is all that was loaded there.
Okay.
And most of them were Vermont Railway cars.
Right. They had a lease on a big bunch of those. But you also said that they were using a lot of all-door cars And some McLeod railway cars?
That wasn't at Mehoopany. That was up at the Masonite plant.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. We'll get to that. Let's stick with Mehoopany for a minute.
So I would go into Procter and Gamble's traffic office. I would go through their bills of lading and sample and check the weights that they were using. And then I would go down onto the floor inside the plant when the traffic guys would go with me, and we would go down there, and I'd just pull a box of Charmin paper off of the line, put it on a scale and weigh it and see if the box of paper weighed the same as what
They
Charmin
said.
is showing as weighing on an outbound car, or get a box of Pampers or a box of Puffs or whatever. But I would weigh 10 boxes at a time to establish an average weight over 10 boxes.
Was there much variation?
No.
Yeah, I wouldn't think
Now,
so.
with the big corporations, you had no problems. It was the little guys who cheated. Because if it was a sole proprietorship or a two-person partnership, every penny they managed to chisel out of somebody went into their pocket. Okay? So they were the ones you had to be careful with. And I had one place. It was on a it was around Pittston. Oh, where was it? But that guy was notorious. Okay? Because if basically most of your paper shipping bags, like for cement or feed or whatever, weigh 2 pounds. So he would put the weights on his outbound shipment. If it was a 50-pound bag, he'd show 50 pounds and not 52 pounds. It's a long time. Then I go in there and I'd have to issue waybill corrections on all the cars he shipped out for the last so many whatever period of time was since the last time I was there. That was a lot of work.
And
But
then he'd get a
not during
bill.
but during that but not that but he didn't have to pay but that little bit of weight until he got a revised bill from the I think it was the Lehigh Valley.
Do
Okay.
you remember who the consignee was?
What?
Do you remember who the customer was?
No, I don't. I sort of remember the building, but that's been over 40 years ago now.
Yeah, or what the
Just thinking
product
back.
was?
What was he shipping out?
I mean, if it's the Pittston area, I probably have records somewhere.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to remember. I just remember him, and it was. I think he was shipping out some kind of like a Christmas ornament or something like that. It was.
Interesting.
Yeah. There wasn't a lot of weight to it, but he did everything possible to see if he could sneak it past you. Okay. Just the way it was. Okay.
So when you're working for this bureau, you are not confined to one railroad. You basically had a territory, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah. Okay. My territory was from the Delaware River through the Lehigh Valley, up through all the anthracite coal areas, up to basically to Sunbury. And
You didn't
then
get into
from there,
Hazleton, right?
yeah, oh yeah, I went to
Oh, you
Hazleton a
did.
lot. Yeah. And then from Sunbury, draw a line to Jersey Shore, and then back in up to the New York State border, and then back to the Delaware River. They
Sounds
went
like a
that way.
big territory.
Oh yeah.
So you were basically driving every day all the time
Yes.
and
Normally
probably staying over all the time.
I spent four days a week on the road and one day at home for office work.
But it must have been nice because you got to be out there looking at trains a lot of the time and not stuck in inside. And I'm sure weather's a factor sometimes, right?
Yeah, no, but most of the time, if I wasn't driving, I was stuck inside. So, yeah, in an office somewhere.
So
Yeah.
you said you went to Mehoopany, which is fascinating. I imagine the inside of that plant was gigantic and they probably were very secretive about their trade secrets then as they are now.
The plant in Mehoopany was so big that that you actually rode bicycles inside of it to move around.
I believe it. I believe it. It's a
they
heck
would
of a
have
footprint.
Designated places with just bicycles parking there, and you would get on a bicycle and take it and go to the other part of the plant wherever you want. And then you would leave your bicycle in a designated spot for somebody else to use.
Oh, I got you. It was like with shared bicycles.
Right.
Wow. And I guess forklifts running around everywhere in the warehouse.
Oh, yeah. Forklifts everywhere.
Wow. And my understanding is that on some of the track loading, they would actually load through one line of boxcars into another. Do you recall that?
There was two tracks parallel to each other.
Yep.
And the loading dock was on both sides of the car. So
both sides.
So they could load through.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you saw no sign of inbound loads like tank cars or anything like that?
No, there was no shipper weight agreement on the inbound loads, so I had nothing to do with that.
Yep,
solid.
I gotcha. And can you think of anything else that you visited in that greater Pittston area? Anything else come to mind?
Well, there was a paper plant just outside of Coxton Yard.
Well, you're probably thinking of Ransom. There was probably Suwannee
Paper.
Oh,
Ransom. No, there was nothing in those areas. Well, Ransom was the paper mill. That's right.
Right.
But the smaller towns between there and Mahoopany, there was nothing.
Right.
The railroad didn't have any shippers.
Right. I think there were a couple of grain mills. You know, there was one in Meshopin. Right. I don't know if you ever got to Kintner Milling there.
But they were receiving inbound loads. They weren't shipping out.
I got you. You were mainly concerned with shippers. I got it. So that brings us up to the Masonite plant then. That's the one that used the all-door boxcars. I bet they had a lot of cars inside too.
Well, it was all, I don't remember any inside tracks at that plant. It was all, there was a track that went on the outside of the plant where they loaded the cars from a dock.
Oh, interesting. Because in later times, like in my era, that was all enclosed.
Okay. No, back in the 70s, it wasn't enclosed.
Interesting.
It was open.
Interesting. So this was the beginning of your career there with this bureau. And it's a mouthful, Eastern Weighing and Inspection Bureau, Eastern Railroad Association. You did that for how long?
Well, I did that for 4 years, but there was other jobs too besides the weight agreements. I also did what was called packaging inspections. I have someone, there's a book called the Uniform Classification Code. And in the Uniform Classification Code lists every commodity you could think of to ship.
Okay. I've heard of the so-called UCC code, but not really familiar with exactly what it was.
And it had a 10-digit number in it. So if a customer come up with a new product to ship, it had to be classified within that code.
Okay.
So I'd have to do what's called a classification investigation and determine what code to be assigned to that new product.
Okay.
Okay. And then I
was
also-
Was it just to break it down into categories, or was there more of a reason for it?
It was, everything was broken down into categories, and I think it was a 10-digit number, if I remember right, it was a UCC number.
Yep.
And that 10-digit number was referred to in the tariffs.
I see.
So that,
it corresponded that with that.
Yeah, the number determined what tariff rates were going to be applied to that commodity.
Right. And we're talking thousands and thousands of these, right?
Yeah, it was a big, thick book with a little tiny print.
Yeah, like an OREER.
Yeah, but it made sense because the number, the numerical order was by commodities.
Okay.
So you know what part of the book to start looking for a given commodity in.
Yeah.
Work it from there. And then I also did packaging inspection, where I would take, like someone was shipping, glassware.
Yep.
Okay. Or furniture. I still remember there was Pennsylvania House Furniture and S.J. Moore Furniture.
Sure.
Bailey, yeah, right. It was S.J. Bailey, I suppose. Yeah, and they all ship furniture. And I go in there and take a furniture they had packaged apart and check that it was properly, all the padding was in the right place. And
okay.
Because again, in the back of the UCC book, there was a whole section on packaging rules and regulations.
Okay. So, and this was to avoid damage claims, I imagine?
Right.
In part?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then occasionally I would also get to have to do damage claims investigations if there was no one on the railroad to handle it. Because I remember a couple times having to go up into New York State on the WAG.
Really?
Yes, because it was so far away from anyone in the New York State territory, and going up as far as Jersey Shore area, I was close to go across the border. And several times I had to go up there and handle some packaging. No, it was claims on freight damage. And
so for WAGs, we're talking Wellsville, Addison, and Gailton.
Yes.
Okay. They had some cool locomotives back then, didn't they? Didn't they have some strange center cabs and things like that?
All I remember is F units.
F units, okay, yeah. I think the weirdo center cabs were probably left in the 60s.
Yeah, they did. And then I also did what's called volume rate certifications. Like, for example, Bethlehem Steel shipped ignit molds out of Bethlehem onto Lehigh Valley.
Right.
Up to Lackawanna, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they had a rate that was based on so many 100,000 tons of ignit molds moving between the two plants and door from January 1st to December 31st. So I would go in there quarterly and certify how many tons had been shipped, for example. And Bethlehem Steel also had volume rates on inbound war shipments.
Of course. I mean, that was Lehigh Valley's number one customer.
Yeah.
And Mehoopany was number two, believe it or not.
It was. And the inbound war come in either off of the Reading or off the Penn Central via Phillipsburg to Lehigh Valley.
Okay.
And
same for coal.
It was magnesium. It was the biggest one that was all handled on the Reading.
Okay.
And yeah, biggest one was that. And then there was also volume shipments out for coke, because Bethlehem Steel produced coke and shipped it out to their other mills.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah. And most of the coke went to their plant outside of Baltimore, Sparrow, was it? Sparrow's Point, Maryland. That's mm-hmm. where most of the coke, and then also some coke went to Lackawanna, New York.
Interesting.
But not very much.
Now, I seem to recall that ingot mold business much later was on the D&H primarily. And yes. I think I've been told that there was new molds going north, but then used molds going back for scrap. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, okay. The Bethlehem Steel had a mold shop in Bethlehem that could also repair damaged molds.
Oh, maybe that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were not just scrapping them, they were repairing them.
Right.
Ah. Okay.
Yeah, that's my memory. I remember that's 45 years ago now, but that's what I believe was going on. Okay.
No, you're doing pretty well, actually, better than I think I would have.
Yes, if they were going to scrap them, they would have just scrapped them on site and threw them in the furnace.
I gotcha. So if I see pictures with southbound stuff, they were going back for repair.
Right.
That makes sense. But then I guess somebody else on that end is verifying the weight of those things, right?
They would have been track scaled.
I gotcha. So if they were track scale, is that what you were doing for the outbound shipments?
No.
Checking the scale?
The shipper's weight agreements were to avoid track scaling the cars.
I see.
You're accepting the shipper's weight instead of the railroad weight in the car.
I gotcha. So on something like an ingot mold, how would you audit their weight of that?
Okay. A cubic inch of steel weighed 2 point something or other ounces, as I remember. Okay. So Bethlehem Steel had these charts made up of exactly how much steel went into a product.
Okay.
Okay. So there was so many tons of steel made that ingot mold. And then that came to so many cubic inches of steel. So you would take your formula, pour it per cubic inch, multiply it out, and you would come up with the weight of the molds. And the molds were all consistently the same size, the same weight.
Right. Once you check one, you know.
Yeah. Everything had to be uniform the same.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like there's X amount of trust involved on both sides, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it would have to be. Trust with verification, as the saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very interesting. So you did this, you said, for 4 years?
Yeah, 4 years. And then as once Conrail happened, instead of working for multiple railroads, I was working representing Conrail, the Chestnut Ridge Railroad, the Northampton and Bath.
Yeah.
And the Delaware and Hudson, basically.
That's the target area. Absolutely. What can you tell me about Chestnut Ridge? It's always seemed to be not a lot of coverage of it, you know, and I've seen pictures of the whole surrounding area with, you know, just devastated environmentally, you know, from the, I guess, was it lead smelting they were doing?
Yes, it was a zinc smelter.
Zinc.
Okay. It was owned by New Jersey Zinc.
Right.
Okay. They got their ore from Franklin, Pennsylvania on the Lehigh and Hudson River.
Okay.
And it came down to Phillipsburg, to the Jersey Central, through Allentown Yard and up to there. And then later Lehigh Valley, once mm-hmm. they took over C&J operations,
mm-hmm.
they had the East Yard and the West Yard on, as I remember, because they had the East Plant and the West Plant as separate yards to serve them.
Alco switchers, I think.
And then they also had the line extended like 10 or 12 miles beyond Palmerton, mm-hmm. up to a small town where they had several smaller customers up there. I think there was a lumberyard, a propane dealer, something like that up there.
Yeah.
But and they used to go up there two or three times a week.
Alco switchers?
What?
Alco switchers?
Yeah, they had Alco switchers. And then the New Jersey Zinc also had their own Alco switchers.
So what was the... What was it like to go into that plant there? I mean, was it like visiting a steel mill, that kind of atmosphere?
Well, the actual offices for New Jersey Zinc were in Bethlehem, an office building in Bethlehem.
Okay.
Right. So all the bill of ladings and all the records were down in Bethlehem in the office building down there.
Mm-hmm.
And then occasionally I go up to the plant and check outbound weights. Okay. The biggest volume they did was they had what they called totes. They were big rubber bags. And they filled them up with refined zinc.
And they were shipped in a powder form?
Yeah. Yeah. Ground up powder form. And they were shipping them to, I think it was Eastman Chemical. And I think they were in Tennessee, if I remember right. And they had their own fleet of special, like, specialty Godola cars. MRCX is what I remember the reporting marks on them being. And they would take these bags and they would put them on a big scale, similar to what you think of a truck scale.
Okay.
And they would weigh these bags and then they would put them into these gondola cars with a crane and ship them to Tennessee. So
that was the primary output of that plant.
Yeah, the zinc. And then I would go up there and go through all of their scale tickets occasionally and watch them weigh in and certify that they were properly weighing them. And again, the weights were important because New Jersey zinc got paid on those weights.
Sure.
So they weren't, again, the larger corporations, you didn't have to worry much about them because
right.
no individual profited from cutting corners.
Yep. Their scales were good.
Yes. Yeah. And I'd have to check scales to make sure that the Pennsylvania state weight to measures or the local county weights and measures, people come in and check them or Morris scales or whoever. Someone was coming in at a minimum once a year and certifying scales.
Right, right. Interesting. So yeah. you did that for into the Conrail era. Was the Pocono Northeast short line viable at that time?
No, it didn't exist yet.
Okay.
Okay, and then I could see the handwriting on the wall that this job's not going to last because Conrail was starting to take things in-house into Philadelphia. Okay? So I sent resumes out. Southern Railroad offered me a job in Macon, Georgia. I think the Sioux Line offered me a job in Minneapolis. I remember the Southern Pacific offered me a job in San Francisco. Things that Burlington Northern offered me a job. And I thought that's the place to go because traffic is expanding on the Burlington Northern. And the rest of the railroad's traffic was like getting less and less. So
sure.
I went to work for the Burlington Northern. The day after Christmas, 1978, was my first day working on the Burlington Northern, Sydney, Nebraska.
And you were doing what?
Working was called, it was called working the telegrapher's list. Basically, agent operators were called telegraphers on the old CB&Q.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So the seniority district was from Pacific Junction, Iowa, to Billings, Montana, everything west of there in the old CB&Q. So I worked the extra board there, and eventually when the Orange Line opened up, you know, all the new operators' jobs come on, 24-hour stations around the coal trains.
Right.
And then after that, I always held regular jobs.
Little different scenery out there, isn't it? From what you were used
totally
to.
Totally different operation.
Yep.
Coming from the East Coast.
Right.
Where you are used to multiple track main lines, flyover junctions of places.
Right.
And density of traffic.
Mountains.
Yeah. Going out there to the old CB&Q Granger Railroad with 112-pound rail. It's the heaviest rail on the main line back then, I remember. The line going down to Denver out of Alliance through Sterling, Colorado. That was 99-pound rail, 90 or 99-pound rail. Okay, light rail on that. And then it started running coal trains on it. It was broken rails all the time.
Now, is that the line that later became the joint line, or am I thinking of something else?
No, that's in Colorado. That's between Denver and Pueblo, Colorado.
Okay. Interesting.
I did
some rail fanning out in Nebraska, and I enjoyed it. It is very, very different out there, but, you know, having wide open scenery like that was kind of amazing.
It took me about 6 months to get used to that.
I'll bet. I'll bet.
It was hard to,
I'll bet winter is no fun out there.
Yeah, it was hard to get used to being able to see for 30 or 40 miles in places.
Right.
And there's nothing out there, okay? And there wasn't any trees, just wheat fields.
What was the winter like?
Oh, the wind blew all the time.
Right, but I mean the snowstorms and everything.
Oh, winter was awful, okay? Okay, basically for about 3 months, you'd wake up every morning and be about 10 degrees below zero or colder. Okay. And I still remember Guernsey, Wyoming. I'm living in Sydney. Second trick operator in Guernsey lived 15 miles from the depot just outside of Torrington, Wyoming.
Huh.
Every
Windy,
time it
Wyoming.
snowed, he would call in to say that he couldn't get out the driveway and he couldn't come to work. So I'd have to drive 130 miles in a snowstorm
Jeez.
to Guernsey, Wyoming to protect his second trick, and then and then get off 11 o'clock at night and drive 130 miles back home. Okay.
They wouldn't put you up out there?
So, you know, I had a Volkswagen, okay? Best snow car I ever had.
Really?
All the weight was in the back.
Oh, yeah, okay? That's true.
Between Dalton, Nebraska, and Bridgeport, Nebraska, you come off a high plateau and you go through a bunch of cuts in the road as it winds down to the North Platte River. Okay, and those are cuts would drift in.
Of course.
Okay, I floored that Volkswagen, get it going as fast as I could. You know, I would hit those cuts and just hold the steering wheel absolutely straight. Okay? I could see a thing. The snow's all coming over the windshield, across
Jeez.
The roof, and behind me, and I pop out the other end. Many a times I pop up out the other end and find a four-wheel drive pickup in the ditch.
Wow.
Well, I just keep on going. You know,
well, you had momentum, so yeah.
I have to work. I didn't have time to deal with people. I'd go to work, okay? Yeah. So that was life on the extra board in Nebraska.
And that was the beginning of BN, and then you did other things for them.
Yeah, because once everything was CTC'd and the union and the railroad made an agreement. They combined the clerk's roster and the operator's rosters together. So then we were all on the clerk's roster. So when there was no more operator's jobs left, we ended up in the yard office in Elias, Nebraska for a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the Frisco, when the Frisco merger happened, they merged the clerk's roster on the Colorado and Southern and the former CB&Q clerk roster together as one roster. And now I have seniority all the way to Clayton, New Mexico. And I got bumped in Alliance. I had a bump coming. And that was after my third winter in Alliance. It was in May. And I looked at the renewed roster, and there was 32 clerk's jobs in Trinidad, Colorado. And Trinidad was 400 miles south of Alliance. I'd never been to Trinidad. I knew nothing about it, but it was 400 miles south of Alliance. It had to be warmer.
Right,
okay?
Right.
And so I bumped to Trinidad. That put me number 16 in seniority down there out of 32 jobs.
Now, it was 400 miles south, but I'll bet it was higher in elevation.
6,000 foot.
Right. Was it warmer?
Yes.
Really?
Oh yeah. You get very seldom did you get freezing sub-zero temperatures like you would get for 3 months at a time up in Nebraska.
Wow.
Okay. So most of the winters were in the 30s, occasionally low 40s. So it wasn't so bad. And occasionally we would get what's called Chinook winds. Would come up from the Gulf of Mexico, and we would be in the 50s or 60s for a few days in the winter. Just nice change.
So very different.
Yeah, very, very different. And so I worked on we always called it the CNS, and that was the Colorado Southern down there.
Mm-hmm. We still call it the Boston and Albany, so I get it.
Okay. So that was the CNS. Yeah, I worked the CNS down there and all the stations. And then it was 1990. Oh, it was 1992, I think it was, and possibly 93. The Burlington Northern had their big quality movement. Okay. They had a quality unit down in Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm.
And they were establishing quality action teams throughout the system.
Here we go, right?
And also during that time, the railroad was consolidating all the clerks that they could into central offices. So I got my notice that they were abolishing my job in Trinidad. There was only like 10 of us left by then. and I was to report to the yard office in Denver, and I was being assigned to the extra board in Denver. So anyways, the two train masters down in Trinidad at that time come up with this idea. Oregon Steel had just bought out Colorado Fuel and Iron in Pueblo. And they were revamping the mill, and the outbound traffic was just increasing out of that mill. There was all kinds of problems with moving the shipments out of the mill. And okay. Oregon Steel was getting pretty fed.
We have some network difficulty here.
Yeah, they would
here.
Make a one-man quality action team to go up to Pueblo and deal with CF&I Steel and see what they could do about it until the merger. Okay. But to Santa Fe, because I got up there, found, as I remember right, found 26,000 tons of traffic sitting around up there with no plan to move it. It was around 300 cars. So that was the first thing to deal with. And then after that was come up with plans to not ever have this happen again and take care of the customer.
Right.
So I worked out the deal with the Colorado Wyoming Railroad, which was owned by the steel mill, to have them start pre-blocking some cars for us. Because prior to that, the steel mill was at a station named Minocqua, which was under the joint line agreement. So the Santa Fe did all the switching up there for the CNS.
Mm-hmm.
And the Santa Fe's method of doing things was to haul everything to Pueblo and switch it out in Pueblo and then add it to outbound trains in Pueblo, which added a couple extra days to your shipments times. Mm-hmm. So I got the Colorado and Wyoming to pre-block everything going south for me. And then started having train 261 at that time was the local from Denver to Fort Worth. He did all the local work. And so we got train 261 to pick up the southbound cars at Minocqua that were all pre-blocked for me, taken to Walsenburg, Colorado, and set them out. Then I'd have train 196 pick up at Walsenburg, the block of cars for Fort Worth and beyond, and take them directly down to Fort Worth. And most of that traffic was oil well pipe.
Ah.
Okay. And it was also coiled steel rods.
Maybe rebar, some rebar maybe.
Right. It would be made in rebar, screwdrivers, you name it, got paid into it. Mm-hmm. And then also for a while, they were shipping out ignits to Italy.
Of all places.
Through the cars were going down to Houston, to the Houston, Houston Belt Terminal Railroad down there.
Yep. And then they put them on a boat.
Mm-hmm. And then after I got CF&I straightened out, it was like, okay, we have more stuff for you to take care of. So over the next year, basically, I got to run the railroad from Colorado Springs to Dalhart, Texas, taking care of making sure everything got picked up and set out and everything.
Now, do you consider that one of the more interesting things that you've done, or was it all equally interesting?
That's one of the more interesting things because I fixed it all.
Right.
It didn't work. Okay, I got to fix and reorganized everything. And it was fun and challenging.
Let me ask you a couple of follow-up questions about how you identified what the issue was and then how you sold the solution.
Well, okay. Well, CF&I Steel needed to get their cars consistently moved out of the mill, and they needed to get them consistently moved to their destinations. So you'll find railroad customers, they're not looking for speed, they're looking for consistency.
Reliability, yep.
Right. So, and it was important when they were shipping the ignit molds, they had to be to Houston to meet a ship at a certain time, date. Okay, so that's how that all came about. And then as far as traffic going north, instead of our northbound traffic going into the Santa Fe yard, we started picking it up with our own northbound trains and avoiding the Santa Fe.
Right.
Okay, so that saved a lot of time running traffic around the Santa Fe.
So you identified a bottleneck and eliminated it, basically.
Yeah, right. And another example of differences in services is we ran out, Burlington Northern ran out of gondola cars one time. Could not get enough gons down there fast enough. And CF&I had a bunch of Santa Fe supply gons in the mill. And they loaded the cars out onto Santa Fe to go to Houston. Okay, what I was doing Houston in 5 days consistently. The best of Santa Fe did was 14 days to Houston. And one of the cars took 21 days, I remember.
Jeez.
Okay.
That's unbelievable.
No, because the Santa Fe operated on their Transcon. Everything was home to Barstow, Argentina, or with. Okay. The rest of the railroad fed into Argentine, basically, whatever, and went back out, a lot of it, okay? And they all of these sidelines, like up to Denver, traffic going into Texas and things, that wasn't part of their main flow.
Right. And this was true of all the big railroads. If you were on Conrail and you weren't on the Big X, they weren't terribly interested.
Right. So then the other traffic we built up was the potato traffic out of San Luis Valley off the Rio Grande.
Mm-hmm.
The San Luis Central Railroad was loading potatoes at Monte Vista, Colorado, and Center Colorado. And originally we started about 50 cars of potatoes a year. And then once I started the CF&I block swap, as I called it, at Walsenburg. Then we put the potato cars were also went into that block swap there at Walsenburg to Schumann Produce in Houston, Texas. And the potatoes were loaded in these old PF&E mechanical refrigerator cars.
Really?
And
I would have assumed they would have just been in an RBL or something like that.
No, potatoes, you have to protect them from freezing and from getting too hot in the wintertime. Okay?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, in summertime, freezing in the winter, summertime getting too hot. Potatoes are shipped at 42 degrees.
Okay.
So we ended up growing that potato business to 500 cars a year from 50.
Wow. A lot of potatoes.
And then I ended up also then taking over control of the interchange with the Rio Grande became the Southern Pacific, because when the Santa Fe merger happened, the Southern Pacific got haulage rights on a new railroad between Fort Worth and Pueblo.
Okay.
And the cars were all handled in Burlington Northern trains. So now we start originating extras out of Pueblo. We would call 196 PB. Would be the train.
Let me make sure I'm clear on. I think most of us know what trackage rights are, but haulage rights means that the railroad has to haul your cars.
Right. The Southern Pacific would pay the Burlington Northern, remember, right, $1,500 per loaded car to take that car to Fort Worth.
Okay.
And give it back to the SP at Fort Worth.
I see.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So then I'd have to get power and Fred and everything in place. And about three times a week, I was operating an extra 1996 out of Pueblo to handle that traffic.
Your job title at this point is what specifically?
I was a customer service clerk.
Okay.
Where Mark Carter was a division superintendent, he used to refer to me as being his quasi train master.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like, you were operating above your pay grade there on a lot of these things.
Yeah, Mark said he kept trying. He wanted to get me promoted, but this is right after Santa Fe merger. And there's a lot of people who lost their jobs.
Right.
And he said, you have the stigmatism of being a clerk. And most people don't think a clerk can operate a railroad.
Very interesting. But you knew it from the ground up. You did you end your BN career on the West Coast?
No. After the merger, I ended up on, Mark Carter got me appointed to the merger implementation team.
Wow.
Okay. And the job I got was we were converting from the Burlington Northern computer system, which was called Compass,
mm-hmm.
Santa Fe computer system, which is called TISS, TSS for Transportation Support System.
Okay.
It's actually a better program than BN Compass.
Which is why they chose it.
Right. Yeah. It was also there in place, just had to be expanded.
Right.
So I spent a year and a half going around teaching Burlington Northern yardmasters how to use the new system throughout the northern part of the system. And the first 3 months of that job involved sitting with the programmers in Fort Worth up in the 16th floor of the Continental Towers building in downtown Fort Worth, with all these contract programmers that were hired that had just gotten laid off by NASA.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, they were telling all the stories about the 7 years they spent doing the programming for the space shuttle. They were the guys who programmed the space shuttle. Okay. It was pretty fascinating to listen to those guys. I learned a lot.
Oh, it had to be. And of course,
computers work.
The kind of thing that you're talking about here kind of blends into my day gig. I mean, you were on endless meetings many of those days, weren't you?
Yeah. So as they were, what they did is they designed what they called the buffer computer. It was in Topeka, Kansas. The Burlington Northern's main computer system was in Fort Worth, with a backup in St. Paul. The Santa Fe system was in Topeka, Kansas. And so the buffer computer would talk to the Santa Fe computer and to the BN computer and change the format from BN Compass to Santa Fe TIS.
Oh, so it wasn't like they switched it over entirely to Santa Fe's system.
Right. The Union Pacific already made that mistake with the SP.
Right. Right. Okay.
So the railroad was broken up into sections, and we changed one section at a time of the railroad into the new Santa Fe system, and it took about 18 months to do that.
I bet. That's actually pretty fast.
So the first 3 months of my work was to sit with these programmers, being about, there's probably about five of us up there, five or six of us. And the programmers would supposedly do something or fix something. And they'd ask us to check it.
Right.
So I go interchange cars to Sioux Line in Minneapolis, or if it was an interchange program, or work perform a train between the Lincoln, New Nebraska, and Galesburg, or whatever, in the new system, because we had a dummy railroad set up basically, and we would move cars to test in there and find out whether what they had done worked or not.
Right.
Well, so we'd find out it worked, but then we would find out they broke something else.
That's what programming is like. I'm very familiar with that process.
Yeah,
highly so iterative.
Yeah, you know, then we'd have to go and see when try this thing out and see if it works or not.
I mean, to think that you did that start to finish in 18 months is impressive.
Oh, it was the whole Burlington Northern Railroad. We switched over in 18 months.
Yep. No, that's wow.
And the way it was done is it was divided into three teams. The first team went in there, and 2 weeks before the cutover was to take place, and trained everybody in how to use the new system, yard masters, clerks, train masters, whatever. Then the second team, I was on the second team primarily, we came in there, and we spent 2 weeks there holding everybody's hands and getting them through it and while they were doing it hands-on. And then the third team would come in and follow us up for another 2 weeks to just mop up and anyone who was on vacation, train them or people who were having a hard time learning the new system. And that's how we did it.
How did the actual cutover go?
It went very well. Overall, I say it went very well because it was methodically done. The whole railroad wasn't done in one day.
Right. Right.
Yeah, we always had some glitches here and there. Okay. But the programmers in Fort Worth were on call all the time to fix them. And things happened and it got fixed really quick.
It must have been a fascinating thing to be a part of.
Yeah. I enjoyed traveling all over the railroad.
Right. Right. Was that pretty much the last thing you did before retirement?
Oh, no, that was just the beginning.
Oh boy.
And then in February in 1997, I went to La Junta, Colorado, Santa Fe Yard there. Assistant train master there for a couple of years. Assistant train master on the Santa Fe is actually a glorified yard master.
Okay.
They just, the Santa Fe yard masters went exempt and they become company officers instead of union guys.
Mm-hmm.
So I've basically spent 2 years being a yard master at La Junta, think of it that way.
So were you a union guy throughout?
Well, Burlington Northern yard masters were union.
Mm-hmm.
The Santa Fe yard masters were non-union.
Yep.
And it's still that way.
But how about you and all of your prior stuff? Was that a union job?
Yeah, I was always union, yes.
Okay.
Transportation Communications Union.
Gotcha.
And then after that, after they put everybody together, we became the Brotherhood of Railway Clerks.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So 2 years at Lahana, and then I went to Amarillo. And I was the tramp guy out of Amarillo for a year, for all of 1999. I covered every train master's job on the Amarillo division from La Junta, Colorado to Slayton, Texas to Wellington, Kansas, everything in between on the Amarillo division. And when I wasn't doing that, I'd work in the tower at Fort Worth. At Amarillo, south tower on a transcon, being yard, you know, ATM yard master up there.
Busy spot.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we'd have 100 trains a day through there normally.
Wow. Basically, my understanding is that a train master is basically a problem solver. All you do is solve problems all day long.
Yes, that's exactly right. I used to say my job was to put a Band-Aid on the railroad and make it run another day.
Yep.
And, and also at times I felt like I was running an adult daycare center, except my kids just had bigger, more expensive toys to play with.
People are people.
Right. And most of it was one guy was so afraid that somebody else is doing less work than him.
Incredible. Incredible. I guess my only question is, when are we going to see trains running on your model railroad?
Oh, I actually got a loop of track down on the lower level that's operational.
Good.
I did that right away, just have something running.
Yep.
I've always had a loop because you could come home from work and just watch a train go around and de-stress.
Right, right.
Okay.
But it is very soothing.
I've been working on this for 1 year.
Yep.
So,
oh, that's only 1 year's worth of work, so that's not much. Yeah.
Yeah. And then from Amarillo, I went to New Westminster, British Columbia, as train master Canadian operations up there.
Hmm.
Okay, and that's because I answered the phone one day in the South Yard there in Amarillo. Kenny Royal, the superintendent of operations up there in Canada, calls me up and says to me, I'm looking for somebody who can deal with U.S. customs and understands customs paperwork. Yeah, I hear you are the guy that I'm supposed to call. Okay, Kenny. I said to him, well, I've way-billed hundreds of cars of pinto beans to Mexico and handled the USDA certificates and certified for the customs paperwork on them. So, oh, you already know more than anybody else here.
How good enough.
Be here.
Jeez.
So I spent time in, it's actually only spent about 10 months in Canada working. I had a work permit from the government to work up there, but my working permit from what they call Customs Canada said that I could fill the job until a qualified Canadian was found to fill the position. So then, that was the general manager of the Alberta Northern, Clayton Jones. After they got taken over, I think it was by Rail America, he wasn't very happy. And he applied for the job in the West, and got it. And I came back to the States.
Yep.
So
yep.
I spent the rest of my career mostly in Everett, Washington, Delta Yard there. And I was also train mastered. And the time I retired, the last few years, I was train master in Bellingham, Washington.
Gotcha. Well, you have laid out quite a saga here. I you answered a lot of questions that I had about areas of the back into the railroad that I just kind of knew nothing about. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah, I feel I've looked at it now. I've gotten to work wheat harvests, wheat rush, sugar beets harvests, steel mills, coal mills, sawmills.
The whole gamut. Amazing.
Yeah, the whole gamut over the years.
Amazing. All right, everybody. Well, that concludes this podcast for this month. We thank Bob for sharing all of that history with us. It's priceless information. And we will pick it up again, hopefully next month. Till then.